Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 2, where we will be talking with Oxford University Research Fellow Beatrice Groves, who has just published the book, Literary Illusion in Harry Potter, with Routledge. Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling. I'm your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. As always, I'm joined by the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars, author of several books, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures, and frequent contributor to HogwartsProfessor.com, John Granger. How are you doing today, John?
It's hot here, Katie. It's Oklahoma City's at almost triple digits, 99% humidity, allergy warnings. But besides that, I'm doing great.
Very good. Well, yes. John, you and I have been talking about how this is such an exciting time in the Harry Potter universe. I think that Dr. Groves' book is just one example of some of the interesting things that are still happening in the Harry Potter universe.
Yeah, I mean, there's never been, maybe since 2007, there hasn't been as exciting a time right now. I mean, we had MystyCon and the Roanoke Potter Festival already this year. LeakyCon, MuggleNet Live, and Chestnut Hill Conference are coming up. We've got Beatrice Groves' new book out, which is really part of a trend of revolutionary scholarship in the field. Generation Hex is coming into its own in the Academy. And we're promised 8 straight years of strike novels and beast screenplays from Rowling, all of which shed new light on Harry Potter. So really, not since 2007 and the publication of Deathly Hallows has there been as much good reason to be excited about life as a serious reader, about, you know, studying the artistry and meaning of the world's favorite books. I mean, this is, you know, the golden age, I'm afraid, for Harry Potter studies.
It's only the beginning. A golden age can last a long time, right?
Yeah.
We're getting new material all the time on which we can carry it forward.
Seriously. Especially, you know, forgive me, the Corman Strike novels, which people haven't really gotten into yet, but I really do believe she's running a commentary on the Harry Potter septology inside that book set, which is
fascinating. Yeah, and I've heard you talk about that, John, and I totally agree with you. And I will say also, they're just fun to read, and I think if people like reading Harry Potter, it's different, you know, it's a different genre, but that she brings that same richness and the characters that are interesting, and of course, she's got that whole ability to, you know, model a genre and to give us a great mystery, and that's actually one of the things that's in Beatrice Groves' book, sort of talking a little bit about the mystery genre that she's able to bring in there. But so without further ado... Let me introduce our featured guest for today. Wow, we're really excited to be able to have Beatrice Groves, Research Fellow in Renaissance English at Trinity College, Oxford in England, here with us today. She is
Thank
a specialist
you.
In early modern literature and Shakespeare, especially focusing on religious themes in Renaissance literature. Dr. Groves is the author of numerous essays, as well as the books Texts and Traditions, Religion in Shakespeare, 1592 to 1604, The Destruction of Jerusalem in Early Modern English Literature, and most recently, and of course our topic for today, Literary Illusion in Harry Potter. Welcome to the show, Bea.
Thank you very much for having me.
We are delighted to have you on. Both of us have really thoroughly enjoyed your book, and we've been sort of trading emails back and forth about all the things we find interesting about it. And your book is so great in that it is, I just want to tell people, it's a pretty compact book. It's only about 150 pages, but it's so rich and it covers so much ground.
Geez.
And I think it's one of these, it's going to be a go-to for anybody who is a researcher on Harry Potter, or really just, I think it's written at such a level that anybody who loves the Harry Potter books will be able to find just a lot of incredible connections to especially the Western tradition in literature. But before we get into all of that, Let's start off just to get us warmed up a little bit. Tell us how you first got into Harry Potter. Where were you when you first read Harry Potter?
So I was an undergraduate at Cambridge, at a college, Trinity College, Cambridge, weirdly. And I was in Great Court, which is, I don't know if either of you have seen Chariots of Fire,
Yes.
but the Great Court run, it isn't actually filmed in Trinity Great Court, it's filmed in Eton, but it's meant to be the Great Court run in Trinity Great Court. So that's where I was. I had a room in that court when I was an undergraduate, and that's when I first read Harry Potter.
What a great place to encounter Harry Potter for the first time.
It was a very it was very Hogwarts-esque type setting for it, which was very nice.
Well, when I was in college, I did a summer abroad at Cambridge University, and that's when I decided that I wanted to become a British historian, basically because I never wanted to leave. So, and a lot of the appeal of the Harry Potter books, I think, for me, is the Englishness of them. I quite like that.
No,
So.
I think that's true, and I think she was very careful. And people, when it started becoming big around Goblet of Fire time, people said, "Aren't you going to introduce some American characters?" And because English things have always done that, like the Great Escape film, you know, it's all English, but we've got to bring in Steve McQueen. We've got to have an American
Right.
character for the American audience. And she was firm and said no. And I think she's absolutely right that for a lot of Americans, they liked the Britishness of it. It wasn't, you know, it the that otherness was part of its appeal.
Right.
And now, of course,
But
she's.
it's had some funny consequences that, you know, that a large part of the books, as we'll discuss, are about English schoolboy fiction about which Americans know nothing. But so this whole genre was introduced to Americans that Rowling is gently mocking, and for us it was a brave new world. This was anyway. Your point's well taken. Yeah, I think she said in her interview when they asked her about adding some American characters, you know, she just said, you know, "I'm not going to throw away 10 years careful planning, you know, to get a few more readers." And she wasn't suffering for readers at the point either. So,
No,
right. Well, and you don't have to, you don't have to throw in Americans to get Americans to read something. I think that's wrong-headed from my
no.
point of view. But
Yeah.
so let's get right into the book, Literary Illusion in Harry Potter. As I said, in this relatively compact space, you have connected Harry Potter with everything from Ovid to medieval mystery plays to Austen and Tennyson. Some of my favorite bits are Monty Python and Fawlty Towers. Oh, that stuff was so great. I was totally on board with all of that. And you have done all of this by focusing on literary allusion in the series. So first, let's just see if we can figure out what is literary allusion and why should we, as Harry Potter readers, why should we be interested in literary allusion?
Right. Well, I take the allusion in a relatively wide way of just texts talking to each other, basically. So when you read a text and you think, "Ah, oh, that's like a previous text," two things that I really like happen. One is that you see the author as a reader like yourself. It's a moment of sort of equality between you, where you go, "Oh, yes, she also, you know, read that Shakespeare play and loved it." But I think also you then have the old text in a new context, and it brings something of its old context with it, and you try and think what's relevant about that old context for this new place. So, to give a non-Rowling example, the character of Bottom in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, he's a weaver, and his name is partly just a crude name. So Shakespeare's is not above that kind of thing. He's got a character called Pompey Bum, for example, in another play. But it also means it's the piece of wood or something at the that a spool of thread is put around, so it's the bottom, and he's a weaver, so that makes sense that he's named after that. But it also reminds us of a very important spool of thread in literature, which is the spool of thread that Ariadne gives to Theseus to let him out of the labyrinth. And at the center of Midsummer Night's Dream, Bottom is changed into a half man, half beast when he gets an ass's head like the Minotaur. And obviously, Theseus's marriage is the sort of overarching narrative that Bottom is fitted into. So suddenly, you've got this moment where Bottom in Midsummer Night's Dream links back to a much older text and brings aspects of that text in, and we have to then work out as readers what we think that connection is doing. Rowling obviously loves her names, and another sort of example of how her names, so in her case, how names link back to earlier texts is the name of Dumbledore, which, as she's told us, has come from Hardy's Mare of Casterbridge. But I think it's really important what it's doing in the Mare of Casterbridge. So in that novel, Elizabeth Jane, who is the heroine, has been transplanted out of her natural world and goes to live with Henchard, who's the mayor, who she doesn't know. She doesn't know that he might have been, though he isn't her natural father. But he's on the up in the world, and he cares about things like how you sound and what kind of words you use. So she has to unlearn her native dialect when she's with him, and she learns not to call bumblebees by their country name of Dumbledores, is how Hardy puts it. And so I like to feel that it's not just that Rowling has taken that name Dumbledore, but that in doing so is a, you know, what we could call a political act of saying that she's on the side, and her world of the magic is on the side of the native language, the traditional Englishness, the kind of thing that a Dursley, so Dursley and Henchard are very much in the same kind of position. They're caring about the surface judgments that other people make about you, and that she's a, you know, she's a Dumbledore person, not a bumblebee person, shall we say.
And, you know, so Harry, I love that, because Harry has been having to stifle aspects of himself, and the idea that Dumbledore, it's almost a reverse, right? That as he's going to this place, he's allowed to be the authentic self that he wasn't allowed to
absolutely
be before.
Absolutely. Cool. So like Elizabeth Jane, yeah.
That's wonderful. And, you know, I have to tell you, go ahead, John.
That and his whole name. I mean, his whole name is a history, right? I mean, he's Old English with, you know, Percival and such, but he's also Brian, which is about as commonplace as you can get a Python reference, probably.
Absolutely. And I do, I was thinking of that, Brian, when Katie was saying about the Python, because that's a really nice example of how a very ordinary name like Brian can also carry some of this freight of meaning. So I think I'm right in saying, and John, you can correct me, that we only hear that Dumbledore's full name includes the name Brian in Phoenix. So it's at the moment when Potter criticism is taking off and people are going, oh, is Dumbledore a sort of Christ figure? And so she puts in this Brian as a yes, he is, no, he isn't, you know.
That's right.
A sort of hilariously non-appropriate messiah name. And so it works both ways. You can both say laughing at people who think he's a kind of Christ figure, and yes, but, oh, maybe he sort of is. So I rather like that.
And, you know, when I was first asking people, so what would you be interested in hearing about on a podcast about Harry Potter, the most common answer I got was, we want to know more about the names. We love to know where the names come from and what do they mean. And I think they're like little puzzles, right, that can give you that can give you little clues to things to work on. And you refer to at least some of these as cratylic names. Hmm. What is a cratylic name, and what do you think are some of the most important of those in the book that are themselves literary allusions? Obviously, we've just been talking about Dumbledore, but what are some of the other ones?
Great. Okay, well, the name cratylic name, it's not actually out there completely yet as a word. So I am on a crusade to try and get it.
I feel much better.
So no one should think I've never heard of that. Well, you haven't, you know, the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary hasn't heard of it either, but I want to get it in there. It was invented by someone called Anne Barton in, I think, the 1980s. And she's a great Shakespearean scholar, and she wrote a book called The Names of Comedy, and in which she invents the name cratylic name from Plato's dialogue, The Cratylus. And in that dialogue, Socrates is talking to someone called Cratylus, and they're trying to understand whether names give us an accurate guide to the thing that is named. So does language have some kind of inherent meaning in it? And Cratylus believes that it does. So Cratylus thinks that everything's name, its sound, for example, will fit the thing that's named. And Socrates points out that this doesn't generally work. So there's no inherent link between a name and the thing it's the thing that it signifies, and hence language is arbitrary, not some kind of divinely guiding sign towards reality.
But Socrates is not a nominalist.
He's not a nominalist, that's right. But one of the great things to have a creator who might want to name things to help the reader find out things about them. So in fact, I think fiction is a critilic world often, and particularly in comedy. And Barton was particularly keen on the playwright Ben Jonson, who is a very critilic namer. He's got some great characters like Zeal of the Land, Busy, who's a busybody kind of character.
I remember that one.
Yeah, that's right. He's great. One of my favourite names. And then in his play The Alchemist, there's someone called Face, and I think that's an amazing name, because you've got sort of ideas of facade and sort of chutzpah, like we have this modern face-off, but also this way in which the word persona, which comes, we get the word person from that, means a speaking through, and it's the name of the mask worn by actors in Greek drama. So Face's name gives a suggestion of the way in which a persona, a sort of the way in which you put on something when you act out a character, which is what he's doing throughout the play The Alchemist. It's opaque, but it's also very expressive about real people, their personas as well. So Ben Jonson's name's often doing things, and that's, I think, where this where Anne Barton's interest in names of comedy came from, and hence the word critilic name. But it's a good shorthand. I think that's why we need it as a word, because otherwise you're left saying a name that denotes the true nature of the thing that is named or something. I think we need a shorter way of doing this, and so I think critilic naming is really helpful for that. You were asking Katie some of my favourite critilic names. Yeah. And I'm not at all surprised that's something people want to follow up on, because it's a really big part of what Rowling is doing. And I love Argus Filch. She's one of my favourite, because Argus is an Ovidian guardian figure, the many-eyed dog. And Filch is someone who steals things in a sort of really small-time kind of way. And I love the idea that his name's at war with itself, you know, that he's meant to be a guardian, he's meant to be a caretaker, but he's actually a filcher. And so that sort of sense of how his name doesn't even sort of work fits with the way in which Argus Filch is sort of always unhappy and, getting obsessed by tiny things and not looking after the safety of the castle at all. I think that's sort of a perfect name for that.
Very good.
I also really like the way that anti-critilic names can work. And Hagrid, sort of his lovable inability to see terrifying beasts for what they are, is shown by his anti-critilic name. So he gives his soppy dog the name Fang and his terrifying dog the name Fluffy.
That's great. That's obviously, and to me, that's a kind of, Python-esque kind of humor, to bring to it too. And you also connect this with particularly Ovid as an important source for a lot of the names in J.K. Rowling. So let's get into a little classic literature. Why is Ovid such an important source of names for her? I guess we know that she was a classicist when she was an undergraduate.
That's right. Yeah. She studied classics in translation, so classical literature in translation, alongside her French undergraduate degree.
And classic studies, right?
Classic studies.
I'm wincing here.
Right. She doesn't
have any Greek or Latin.
Okay.
Really, so.
and you're quite right to say that, John, because obviously people often say she studied classics, and that's not exactly true. But it is the case that she was able to kind of, as it were, get right in the stories as a result.
Right.
She wasn't someone there worrying about how to learning the Greek and Latin. She was just going straight for the myths. And she's written this lovely piece, which John and I have both read, called What's the Name of That Nymph Again? And it's not easy to get hold of, but she wrote it in 1998 before...
Is this like The Thousand Jewels or there's something like
that?
Yeah. I'll find it.
But I really enjoyed it because it's very lighthearted, but it's also very revealing. I felt the sort of, the fame glass wall hadn't come down yet then.
Absolutely.
And there's lots of bits about the Metamorphosis, which is Ovid's epic poem, in that and showing that she really enjoyed it. And she has revealed on Pottermore that when she was first naming Transfiguration, she named it Metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. Changed it later, but that sort of, I think that points to how much she loves the poem. And it is a very, very influential poem, partly because it just has lots and lots of little good stories in it. And some, you know, some editors of it claim it's the most influential poem ever written. That might be overstating it, as editors are wont to do. But it's nonetheless, it's a big text. And some of her names, so Merope and Narcissa and Lupin's, so Remus is Lupin's first name, mm-hmm. they're all Ophidian names.
Right, and so when you know something about that, the metamorphosis, and when you know something about those characters who previously had those names, which are unusual enough that they do become like a symbol of the qualities of each of those people, then that brings something into this new text in Harry Potter that we're supposed
Absolutely.
To be paying attention to.
Absolutely, and I, for example, I think the Remus Lupin name, so Romulus is the much more famous mm-hmm. twin, so they're Romulus and Remus are suckled by a wolf, so that's the obvious reason he's called Remus, is part of his lupine wolfy name. He's like wolf, it's really showing us not very subtle name. But I think more importantly, Remus is the less famous one, the unsuccessful brother, and I feel that is part of Lupin's position as the oppressed and sort of outcast character. That's why she's called him Remus, not Romulus. And I talk in my book about the different ways that Remus is portrayed in Plutarch and in Ovid, and there's quite a different response to him, and I think she's taken a more Plutarchan route, in fact, who we know she likes Plutarch as well. She's mentioned that in her Harvard address. So it's one of those names where it's certain that that's where it came from, because there are no other Remuses around, and then you can start digging at the way in which he's portrayed, and I think there's lots of rich reasons there.
Right, and you know, one of the I think we've heard about Hermione being connected with Hermes before, mm-hmm. and I was also interested in how you connected Hermione with hermeneutics, which
It's a lovely word. I love the way, because hermeneutics is named after Hermes, mm-hmm. because Hermes is the messenger god. So he tells humankind what the gods are planning. So a bit like Cratylus, it's a name that means, you know, it's a Cratylic word, hermeneutics. It means it's as if the gods have encoded reality with meaning, mm-hmm. and hermeneutics is the study of what they were intending us to know, just like Hermes would come and tell us. And Hermes is other name is Mercury, and as John showed us in the Deathly Hallows lectures, you know, Hermione's initials are HG, which is the chemical formula for Mercury, so that's another double link back to the Hermes.
And her parents are dentists.
Yeah, he's saying that, yeah.
I mean,
I don't think they use Mercury fillings anymore, but...
No.
I'm sorry. I know, but that's still the association. Yeah. It's really like you're talking about the pounding of Remus Lupin. Hermione Granger is another one with the HG and the feminine of Hermes and the parents being dentists. Like, okay, enough. We get it.
You know, I also think this is something that B talks about too, that the fact that they're dentists is also kind of played for a laugh, and it kind of is so muggle to be dentists somehow.
And it's this little secret thing again, you know, when, you know, there's just this sort of off strange joke, you know, when Ron says, oh, we could ask Hermione's parents, that would be safe, and she's very safe, they're both dentists, and it's just this little joke, but actually it's a little sign that Nicholas Flamel is a real person in the Muggle world too. So if you had asked the Muggles Nicholas Flamel, they might have said, oh yeah, he's an alchemist.
And
so that's
as a historian, so another, I just was picking out some of my favorite things that you talked about. I, of course, love that you talked about the name Gaunt and the connection English history and the Wars of the Roses.
Mm. So I think that's not something that's been picked up particularly before, and obviously may or may not, you know, agree with it. And that's one of the things with illusion, is that people don't always see the same things. But I think that... Shakespeare makes the joke in Richard II that Gaunt says, you know, I'm Gaunt like my name, you know, so this sort of hollowed out aspect of the name because he's, you know, very old. And that's definitely there in Voldemort's grandfather, and is all sort of hollowed out. But what I'm suggesting is that the sort of pure blood ideology that is a sort of a bigoted version of the Little Englander outlook, which most people would associate with Gaunt in Richard II, above all, is the Sceptred Isle speech. That's this, and Sceptred Isle speech is not actually, you know, it's not a Little Englander speech at all, but it has become that way. You know, that's how it's sort of been taken in popular culture, is, you know, England's cut off in this precious jewel in its silver sea, and we like it that way. You know, it's I'm sure Brexiteers rather like that speech. And so I think
this is fun because you say we get to spar on this a little bit because you're mentioning the Shakespearean reference, but isn't the Thackeray, you know, the fact that the family Gaunt is such a big deal in Vanity Fair, and they're the family is already, that the aristocratic family is already in collapse. I thought that was a more, even though I think, as you say, this intertextual back and forth, that Thackeray is referring to the Gaunts.
Yes.
That speech. But Rowling seems to be saying, hey, here's what's happened to that family. This is actually of that time of Vanity Fair, that the Gaunts have descended to this point.
I did find your Thackeray link, which is on the Hogwarts Professor post. I did find that very convincing, partly because, as you say, it is sort of House of Gaunt link, but also because of that dark mark possible link as well. But I do think, you know, it doesn't have to be just one thing.
The name
can bring in all these. And as you say, Thackeray obviously is bringing in Shakespeare too. And you know, he's, I think, that sense of a royal family. Gaunt is a of royal blood. So, you know, the top aristocratic type family is there as well. So you.
And all of them are referencing this, the play of the name Gaunt, that it has this, as you say, this meaning of being hollowed out. This is an empty front. So it's. I mean, you use the words literary allusion, and I think that's very prudent. The academic term is intertextuality, which I think immediately puts people to sleep or makes them run for the exit. But it's exactly this conversation between texts that you're talking about, which is so much fun for the serious reader to be doing the, wow, is this Thackeray? Is this Shakespeare? Is it both? Is it all of them or none of them? There's certain parts of the brain, I think, that must fire in the serious reader when these names come up.
You find a link. No, and I was thinking, you know, I love these names that, these allusions that are more than one. So a really nice example of this for Shakespeare is the famous translation of Proust's A la recherche de temps perdu by Scott Moncrief is called The Remembrance of Things Past, and Proust scholars don't like that name because it's not a very good translation. But he is referencing Sonnet 30 in Shakespeare, and people often know that and know that he's trying to bring some of the sort of nostalgia of that sonnet into his text. But what they don't often realize is that Shakespeare is actually quoting. That's not Shakespeare, that's the Geneva Bible, Wisdom of Solomon, The Remembrance of Things Past. So although Scott Moncrief doesn't know that he's Shakespeare quoting, he is nonetheless. So it has, you think, you know, these things that just go back and back. And I think that's one of the things I love about allusion. And people sometimes, you know, criticize Rowling for being derivative, but using other people's texts is not a sign of not being a good writer. You know, Shakespeare is the ultimate magpie. He will take anything from anyone, and, you know, it's what you do with it that matters.
And I think, too, it's part of what gives this whole series such richness that we can keep talking about it, is that, and there's not just one, like, I've figured out this, and so now I have nothing more to talk about because I've solved the riddle of what the Harry Potter books mean, and that's it. There's always something more to.
And the debate. I mean, we were talking. V was talking about Ovid, and, you know, Rowling saying in '98, I've graduated, but I have more books on my shelf now about mythology than I did as an undergraduate. But we also see names like Remus Lupin pop up in Nabokov, who she says is the writer that she really loves. So is that to say that she didn't get it from Ovid, or is it that she the name had a special resonance when she saw it in Nabokov? She says, "Oh, look at that! I'm looking for a character that's a werewolf, and those quarters of her brain that light up at illusion went, oh, this is too good to be true."
No, I think that's right. And when you meet it again later, it can be both things. And as you say, we might then see her reading an illusion as well as finding the illusions ourselves.
So I think our listeners can probably already tell just how varied the references are that you're tackling in your book, B. And again, this is done in such a very readable readable form. The way that you have your book organized, you've divided it into chapters on particular sources of literary illusion. You do have a chapter that's particularly focused on the names themselves, so people can read more about that as they will. But you're connecting with not only ancient epic literature, but also medieval literature, Christian tales like mystery plays of the Middle Ages, but also the early modern period, Shakespeare, Jane Austen, the Victorians, right? You've got all kinds of things, but you've sort of nicely divided them into chapters. When you're thinking about all of them together, when we think about, what is this J.K. Rowling's bookshelf, which, John, you were just talking about. What does this tell us, do you think, about what Rowling is particularly drawn to and what her habits of mind are and how they're reflected in the Harry Potter series?
Yeah, I suppose my first answer would just be, capacious. She's clearly a big reader, and she's always, when people say to her, what's your advice for writers, she always says, read, and she's someone who follows her own advice on this. They're all pretty classic texts. John has followed through some more obscure ones, and I suppose I've stayed with things that I thought are of more general interest to people and that readers might be more aware of. And I suppose we're also biased by our own reading. I Shakespeare and Jane Austen were two of my biggest areas that I looked at, and they are two of Rowling's favourite authors, but they're also my favourite authors. So that kind of makes sense that those are the people I would find, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes, but you haven't. Did you go back and read all the Jacobean revenge tragedies after the Silkworm?
No, I do. I do.
I mean, that's obscure. I couldn't believe it. I had to go interlibrary loan to find some of these texts. I couldn't believe that she was dropping lines from these plays that even a specialist like you said were relatively obscure. It made me feel a lot better.
No, I mean, some of those are you just thought, what? Really? Is anyone outside in the department ever read this?
So when I was in college, I took a class that was wonderful called Shakespeare's Contemporaries, Cynthia Lewis at Davidson College. And I always thought it should have been called Why Shakespeare Was So Great. Because you read some of these, especially some of these revenge plays, and you just think, oh my gosh. I mean, the plays themselves they're so ridiculous that they're actually really wonderful to read. It's sort of like, I sort of feel the same way about Gothic. I mean, they just revel in the misery, that there's something good about them. But the fact that she's bringing those relatively obscure plays into our consciousness.
Now I'm learning a lot about you, Katie, because earlier you were saying how enjoyable the Cormoran Strike novels were, and I was thinking of Career of Evil, where a woman is dismembered almost every fourth page. I'm thinking, gosh, that was a lot of kinks and giggles in there.
I haven't read that one, I confess. That's the third one, right? I haven't read that
yet. Yeah, well.
I'm gearing myself
It gets a lot nastier. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
The Jacobean revenge drama. You'll recognize it. You'll recognize it in there.
But it was great for us that she does have these hyper obscure plays quoted in that book, because you think, well, I'm not being weird in thinking she might be referencing Jane Austen. If she can reference things like this, then clearly she's someone who loves illusion. That's something she's obviously really enjoys playing with.
And she's not just picking things that she thinks her readers will already know, which I think is interesting too.
One of the reasons I'm most excited about this book, The Literary Illusion, Harry Potter, I'm going to try to say the title at least 40 times during this talk. The reason that Literary Illusion in Harry Potter is such an important work, coming out right when it is, I mean, we're in a wave of new literature. We've had Patrick McCauley's Into the Pensieve, we've had Shira Volosky's Riddles in Harry Potter, and now this book. But this book especially, I think we're finally turning a corner in Potter studies where we're beginning to see that Rowling is writing about reading and writing. That there's so many embedded texts, not only in terms of literary allusions, but actually there are books and things inside the books where characters are reading the books. In The Silkworm, they're actually reading a book called The Silkworm that we're reading ourselves. I mean, she's not being especially subtle that she's asking you to reflect on what the readers are reading and what that means.
And also in that case, so that is itself an allusion to Jacobean theatre, because Johnson's Devil is an Ass, the main character is going to see a play called The Devil is an Ass.
That's right. So she is in terms of literary allusion or intertext, she is waving a large flag to the reader that this is what I want you to be doing, is thinking about reading.
And I did feel so that phrase, there's a critical phrase about allusion which says it's books calling to each other across the centuries, which I really like as an expression. And I thought, you know, the books in Harry Potter, they talk. So we've got we've got the shrieking, obviously, ones. But we've also got and Riddle's diary writing back to you, which is a kind of talking. There's a bit where Hermione shuts Magic Most Evil, and it complains about being shot, you know, and she says, "Oh, shut up."
And don't we hear the books? The books are whispering in the library.
And I love
right?
that. That's how they whisper. So when he first goes into the library at night, he hears the books are whispering to each other.
And that's the veil in book five.
Yeah,
it's like past the, it's the dead people speaking to you.
Yes, and I mean Stephen Greenback very famously began sort of his first book, I began with the desire to speak with the dead. Said that's why he became a literary critic. So it does all, you know, it all links up. And I just think by having so many books that are literally talking, she is actually, that is a little clue towards the importance of allusion within her text.
And that she's not only, I mean, this is where we get to the derivative original thing, that all of these conversations she's having are very original, that she's really writing parody and then an example of what she's, you know, gently mocking. So that, I mean, she talks about her three favorite writers being Austen, Colette, and Nabokov, and all of them are parody writers. I mean, she's saying, I'm writing the kind of books that I like to read. Here are the things that are, and only now, with books like your own, are we beginning to have this conversation about the books really being about books.
Mm. And I think you're right about the thing about, you know, doing something new. So an example that I talk about is one that she's, again, that she's said explicitly that she's doing, which is the relation of the tale of the three brothers with Chaucer's Pardoner's tale. And there's a lot of quite close links between those, including a sort of an interpretation of the Pardoner's tale where the old man that the three brothers meet is himself death, which is interestingly, I don't think is what most Chaucer scholars think now, but it was a very dominant reading of that in the sort of 80s and 90s. And that, I think she's sort of taken that interpretation and brought it into her version where they do indeed talk with death. And on a liminal space as well, they meet death on a bridge. And in the Chaucer tale, they meet the old man as they're crossing a stile. So that sort of moment of a liminal space. But her text is about something completely different to Chaucer. So Chaucer's is, it's, you know, the root of evil is greed. And you could obviously say that people, you know, who want the Elder Wand and things are greedy, but what her tale is really about is the way in which we approach mortality, and the youngest brother, he's the wily and the innocent. He gets the invisibility cloak, which allows him to escape from death. But it's not about escaping from death. It's about facing up to death, and he's able to take it off and meet death as an equal later when he's ready to die. And I think that's really important for how she's thinking about death in the whole of Harry Potter. But it's not really in the Chaucer.
That's
right. No, you're doing the same thing with it.
This is so good. And again, to the listener, Katie said this was a small book, but really it's 150 pages that in an American publication would be 300.
It's tight.
That's right.
It's tight.
That's right. And each one of these chapters is worth the cost of admission. That really Bee's discussion of the Chaucer, the Gawain, the Guiler Beguiled, each one of these chapters resets Potter punditry, Potter scholarship, and is a new point that which everyone else speaking from this point forward will have to reference and grasp. But seriously, right, you're being almost glib in describing your argument, B, in that, I mean, you discuss in the book how Chaucer is basically doing an intertext himself, because the pardoner is, the whole story is really about a reflection on the pardoner and his relationship with the troop that he's in going to Canterbury, and that we're seeing the same thing really where Rowling is discussing, you know, the tale from Beetle the Bard and how each one of them interprets that story on its several levels. I mean, I talk about that in Deathly Hallows Lectures, where you're seeing that story interpreted at four levels inside the book, and as is the symbol. But that's what Rowling is taking. That she's saying it's not just the actual subject matter of the Pardoner's Tale, but the fact that they're discussing this text inside the Pardoner's Tale.
I'm
sorry to beat that to death. I want to hear you talk about Macbeth.
Right, I was going to just say, because this is a nice segue to Macbeth, because what you talk about in terms of how you think she's alluding to Macbeth is also itself an active interpretation of that text that may not actually be the dominant interpretation. So do you want to talk a little bit about what you think she's doing with Macbeth and what that interpretation is?
Yeah, so this is the prophecy bit of Macbeth. So she has said that she is, she's called it the Macbeth idea. So the way in which she's talking about the prophecy, particularly in Phoenix, is that she thinks that in Macbeth, the Weird Sisters don't make Macbeth kill Duncan, but they sort of implant the idea in his head, and then he chooses to follow it through. And obviously you don't have to read Macbeth that way. I would say that I think most productions probably do kind of follow that. So there are sort of two other ways.
Most postmodern productions do, because choices are, you know, semi-divinity.
Yeah, that's right. We're not that keen on fates controlling us so much. But there are productions that do it differently. So there are ones where you have the witches sort of starting with little voodoo dolls of Macbeth and kind of making him do stuff, and that you feel he is completely in their control. You also have the sort of opposite version where they're entirely the creation of his own mind, you know, and so when they tell him this stuff, he's saying, oh yes, you know, I was already planning to murder Duncan, and they've just kind of brought you into reality through this, which is sometimes how people do Hamlet's father as well. And I suppose, yeah, so I suppose that's, I mean, obviously you can't quite do that on stage, because obviously these people have to be played, but in film or something you could do it where they're just disembodied voices, and then you think these are some kind of promptings of his own mind. John has spoken as how he thinks that Rowling's interpretation of Macbeth will now become the dominant interpretation of Macbeth, and I suspect that is true, that for, you know, sort of people growing up with prophecy are going to see Phoenix, you know, going to see prophecy working in that way.
So it's interesting, because as you talked about, like, literary illusion is making the reader and the writer, putting them kind of on an equal plane, and putting them both in the position of interpreter. It's sort of an interesting thing that happens there too, to bring them together, which is really neat. Now you have two separate chapters. You have Shakespeare gets his own chapter, and Jane Austen gets her own chapter too. I know those are two particular areas that you're interested in, as you talked about. We talked a little bit about Shakespeare, and you actually do more with Hamlet and Midsummer Night's Dream. So there's much more for our listeners to look at as they get your book. But you also have some very interesting things to say about Jane Austen, and I think particular interest. You do a really nice bit about Emma, which she said is her favorite book. But I wondered if we could talk a little bit about Jane Austen's kind of quasi-gothic novel. It's a gothic novel, sort of. Northanger Abbey, which is itself an allusion to the novels of Anne Radcliffe and the gothic genre. And she, J.K. Rowling, appears to be kind of in a Northanger Abbey reference, you know, is then referencing those other references. And so how does that then tell us we should be thinking about the gothic elements of Harry Potter, the ghosts and the, you know, all those, you know, the stories of the past that that are kind of floating around in the Harry Potter series?
Yeah, I do see Rowling and Austen as having a, you know, quite similar response to the gothic, as in perhaps, you know, both of them slightly taking the mickey out of it, you know, making it something comic.
Right. I had a friend who called Radcliffe, actually, but Northanger Abbey does this more, but the kind of Scooby-Doo mysteries, you know, it's not really a dead body, it's just a wax mannequin, you know, it's just grandma pretending so the real estate developers won't take her house.
Right. So, and I think, you know, so when we have the Grimm in Azkaban, that's very much that kind of thing, that, oh no, it's not some kind of prophet of death, it is your godfather hanging around watching you play Quidditch, you know. So there's definitely a part of, you know, putting this gothic machinery of the uncanny fear kind of just back in the box, as it were, and saying you don't need to worry about these kind of things. And that's how most people read Northanger Abbey, is just laughing at people who are too obsessed by the gothic. And I do think Austen is sort of primarily, you know, is doing that. She is a realist writer in many ways, who doesn't like the fact that gothic has completely taken over the publishing genre at her time. I think, you know, 80% of novels sold when Austen was writing were gothic novels. But she's
only really chews out Catherine Morland for her gothic sensibilities. He does this whole thing about, like, what country do you think you're living in? You know, England is a modern country where things like that don't happen. So
that's,
I think,
right.
That's, yeah.
But then we do find that she's more right about things than we might suspect. So the main, you know, the main ways is that both Henry and Eleanor are kind of, you know, she wants to believe that they're kind of perfect, and they sort of just are, you know, and she wants to believe that their father is an ogre, and, you know, he is. So it's not, you know, he's not an ogre, he hasn't murdered his wife, he's not that kind of ogre, but he's keeping his daughter completely trapped. So it's a sort of modern life, you know, he's not locking her up with lock and key, but she has fallen in love with someone else, and he can't possibly marry her because he's not rich or powerful enough, and so her father would never allow it.
And he sets her into the street. It's like you mentioned Prisoner of Azkaban, and we have the kind of the mocking, as you say, there's this supposed, you know, superstitious element, and everybody's kind of laughing about the Grimm, and Trelawney is playing up in it, so we're definitely cued to laugh at the Grimm. And then we have that ending in the Shrieking Shack, which is, you know, gothic plus. Gothic on steroids, and we experience the horror, the terror, all the things that you know, the sort of the Calvinist, you know, there's a larger world out there you had no idea about, right around the corner, ready to snatch you. I mean, that she delivers everything a gothic story is supposed to deliver in this mockery of the gothic, I think, forgive me if I'm stealing your thunder here, but that was such a wow part of your book, which is called Literary Illusion in Harry Potter. That, you know, not only do you make this link, but this discussion about how she's delivering a gothic novel while gently mocking the genre, but also that Rowling gets this, and we know that because of that cabinet.
Yeah, Yeah. So this is the sort of, yeah, this is a sort of exciting moment, is that there's a black and gold cabinet in Catherine's room when she gets to the Abbey, and she assumes some deep, dark secret will be lurking in there. And then when she finally, you know, she breaks into it in a storm and everything, is very exciting, gothic kind of moment. And then she finds that it's just got washing bills in, and she thinks that she's been foolish and let her gothic imagination run past reality, and that these are just washing bills and it's embarrassing. And then in the very end of the novel, sort of a final sentence of the novel, we're told that those washing bills actually the young man who'd stayed at the Abbey, and he's suddenly elevated to grand status and gets to marry Eleanor at the very end. So it turns out that they were a clue to a secret romance after all. So they were exactly what Catherine had hoped they would be, while initially thinking they were just a sort of anti-Gothic thing. So it works brilliantly in terms of having your cake and eating it for Austen. You know, she's able to sort of laugh at the Gothic, but then make them into this sort of exciting secret thing. And it's exactly the same that a black and gold cabinet is in Hogwarts, of course. And it seems like it's a nothing, you know, it's just a vanishing cabinet that is smashed by nearly headless Nick in chamber, and initially we think no more of it, and then obviously then it becomes important cabinet, which then brings the Death Eaters in, and so it acts in this, you know, sort of gothic way of sort of terror and lurking within the castle and the secret passages and all that kind of things there. And I loved the fact that it was a black and yellow cabinet as well. So I felt that was a kind of a direct little pointer to Northanger Abbey there.
You also bring it back in with Rowling taking the ghosts actually very seriously at the end, the ghosts who start out as comic, really, but that the stories of what happened in the past actually are really important. Of course, as a historian, any time the past resurfaces and influences people of the present, I definitely stand up and to pay attention. But I think that also I thought was a really compelling point that you made about the Grey Lady, for example.
And I think, you know, it took me a long time before I realized that that's who it was who was walking past Harry in book one. He goes off for a nighttime ramble, and a tall grey woman ghost goes past him. And we don't really hear anything about her from then on. And then suddenly she resurfaces in the last novel as this crucial part of the story. I think with the ghost as well, so John is very keen on the way that the first and the final novels link around the middle one, Goblet. And we get very important ghosts sort of suddenly surfacing Goblet with the Priory Incantatum moment. And that, in fact, was a moment that sort of first set me off on thinking about literary illusion in Harry Potter, because the way the ghosts reappear in the order in which they're killed happens in Richard III. So just before the Battle of Bosworth, all the people Richard has killed appear in the order they've been killed as ghosts, and utter curses over him and give strength and support to Richmond, who's about to kill him. So it was a very close moment, I felt, to the way in which these ghosts reappear and support Harry and terrify Voldemort. And also similarly, that Richard and Voldemort seem like complete psychopaths who don't care at all about the people they've killed. And, you know, they don't seem like they're worried. And yet at this moment, suddenly when the ghosts reappear, even they start feeling scared by what they've done. So it did seem like quite a close moment, I think.
That's brilliant. And really, serious readers of Harry Potter need to get a copy of Literary Illusion in Harry Potter. We're just bouncing off the surface of the arguments that Professor Groves presents here.
Right. And you know, I was just thinking about all the things that we're about it. We're getting close to our hour point here, but we didn't talk about Gawain and the Green Knight, and we didn't talk about there's a lot of interesting connections with religious literature and the kind of ideas of Harry as a Messiah figure. And I also loved, you've got the last two chapters are really about love and death, which are two central themes that Rowling talks about. And I very much appreciated how you took romantic love very seriously. I think it's something that people, I don't know if people feel kind of, embarrassed about, you know, talking about romance in the books or romantic love, or they feel like it's maybe a little silly or something. But I think J.K. Rowling is really serious about romance, and you take it seriously, and you're able to show that, you know, that seriousness of purpose through, I think, the literary allusions. So I like that part very much, too.
Ah, great. I had a friend who was saying to me that she felt that the sort of the romance between the older characters was crucial in Half-Blood Prince. And I thought, yes, that's absolutely true. We don't hear much about the older characters being in love with each other until then. And then you get, you know, you get the Mrs. Weasley talking about how she fell in love with Mr. Weasley, and we get Tonks and Lupin very subtly done. I really like the way that we don't kind of hear about the fact that Lupin has changed his mind about being with Tonks, but we see at the funeral of Dumbledore that her hair has changed back to a bright colour, so we know that he must have relented on that, you know. And I think that's, we're meant, you know, we're thinking
and
about Dumbledore
pink.
At that moment.
Pink, it's the pink. Cheesiest love colour ever.
But it's also, it's a very nice way of giving something positive. And I think, you know, I think Rowling is a very optimistic writer, and so although we're meant to be, you know, full of the grief of Dumbledore's death at that moment, it's a little moment of hope, and as is the fact that it ends, you know, we've got to go off and fulfill the quest and find the Horcruxes, but they say, well, we can't do this until Bill and Fleur's wedding's happened. And you think, well, you know, if it's saving the world or attending your brother's wedding, then I think yes, you can do that, you know. Bill and Fleur, like, but she's very no,
you have to go through Miss Weasley or not.
Yeah, that's right. But it's very, you know, it is very much she's putting that back in the center. And I think, you know, one of the reasons for that obviously is the Snape subplot. And we were talking about the Gothic earlier, and Snape is, you know, absolutely the Gothic brooding hero, the Marmite, you know, love him. But yeah.
Well, but you've also got a great reference between him and a character in Tale of Two Cities, which I will just leave that for readers to get the book. So, yeah, but I thought Snape...
You're a tease, that's
good. Yeah, that's right. We've got to leave something for the... Although there's tons left that we haven't talked about.
One thing, I want to jump in here, because I'll be accused of you know, not acknowledging this, is that Professor Groves' discussion of the Guiler Beguiled and the Deception of the Devil really supplants almost 20 years of work on discussion of the Christian content of the series. And as I've been
supplant.
That guy,
oh my gosh.
As I've been that guy carrying the point, and I've got the scars to prove it. I am delighted to pass the step. But seriously, anybody that doesn't believe that there is important Christian content in the series, can now, I mean, I've been accused of being, you know, a Christian apologist, reading into the text, projecting my beliefs into the story, believe me, I continue to wag my head over that. But still, having read your chapter in which almost nothing, and I'm fairly current on that literature, almost nothing that has been said is repeated other than to acknowledge it very gracefully, you take it to an entirely different level and make the assertion that these books do not have Christian content borderline absurd. And so, again, any reader that is interested in what Rowling is after on the larger plane, on allegorical, inagogical levels, this book is really invaluable. You really can't move forward in that discussion without reading that chapter 4 in Literary Allusion in Harry Potter.
So
end of verb there, right?
Right, and let me say too that for readers who want a little taste, Bea has very kindly put up some excerpts and also some little like director's cut things that were like left out of the book on things like connections to Sherlock Holmes and the harrowing of hell, but you call it the harrying of hell, on both Hogwarts Professor, and they're on MuggleNet too. And there's a good selection there on MuggleNet. I think if you were the guest blogger for a week, is that right, Bea?
That's right. Yeah. So I did 5 posts on MuggleNet.
And I was the last the week of June time. There.
Yeah.
So if you go back to the post from the end of June, you will be able to see 5 really great, just little tidbits that will give you a feel for all the wonderful things in the book. So our last question to you, B, is if you won MacArthur Genius Grant tomorrow in order to continue your work on literary illusion, what would be your next project? You don't have to, you're not teaching classes, you have the ability to just focus on literary
freedom.
Illusion. What's your next thing?
Just burrowing away in the library. It would be on biblical illusion in Shakespeare.
Woo!
So
that's a big one.
It's a big one.
Yeah.
It's a big one. But
gosh.
I think there's still lots more to do. There's a great guy called Naseeb Shaheen who sort of followed it through, and he found over 1,000 illusions. Which again, and actually what John was saying about Rowling, you know, a lot of people say there's no, you know, there's nothing Christian or biblical in Shakespeare. And you think, well, there are 1,000 biblical illusions in Shakespeare. You know, it's pretty weird to say he's not engaging with the Bible at all, you know. So I think, though, that there's a lot more to do on that. I wrote my doctorate on Shakespeare, and I spoke to my tutor, and I said, is this crazy, you know, to try and do more on Shakespeare? And he said, there's more, you know, more has been written on Shakespeare than on anyone else, and there's more still to write on Shakespeare than anyone else. So I'm taking that to heart.
To our audience of listeners that may have not have done a critical literature review, basically, we can say goodbye to Professor Groves because she has disappeared into the Bodleian for at least a decade to catch up on the critical literature. I've been doing a critical literature review on Rowling in the last year, and it's been a very intense year. And because there's been a tsunami of articles of let's say mixed quality that's been done in the last 10 years, I can't imagine what the Shakespeare studies on biblical illusions.
They say that an article or book is published on Shakespeare every 7 minutes.
Oh my gosh.
So even if you'd read all of them up till now,
that's
you'd
right.
never keep up.
it's worth doing. And that Rowling is, because she's this intertextual writer, that she is, you know, really, as Miranda said about her echoing, her ring writing, that she's the maestro of reprise, not only inside of her books, but in this conversation of the books whispering in the library. What you're doing is invaluable. As the so-called dean of Harry Potter scholars, I want to say thank you so much, because the seriousness of your work and the value of it, and the fact that it's so accessible. I'm afraid from this conversation, people are going to think that this is eggheads only.
It's a lot of fun. You know? It's actually a really fun book. I've really enjoyed it thoroughly.
That's right. There is no more. You know, again, we're getting this new wave. We've got Cyril Olasky's book. We've got Patrick McCauley's book. These are invaluable additions. This is the tip of the wave, though, if you will. This is the tip of the spear. This is. The freshest and most important work that's been done in a very long time on Harry Potter. And the fact that you've posted things at Hogwarts Professor on the Harrying of Hell and the conversations that we're having there on that thread about Piers Plowman and other things, I mean, this has been such a delight for for myself personally and for the readers at MuggleNet and Hogwarts Professor.
Thank you so much, John. We've had a very welcoming community, which I really enjoyed joining.
Yeah, and you know, just you have a quote in your afterword from J.K. Rowling. And another thing that I think people are really going to enjoy is that you are sort of based on the premise of literary illusion, that the writer and the reader in conversation with each other, you have lots of quotations from J.K. Rowling about what she thinks she's doing and the books that she likes and so on. And you have this quote at the beginning of the afterword where she says, "If it's true that Harry got people reading, anyone who wouldn't otherwise have enjoyed books or started to enjoy books, then that's the best thing anyone could say to me." And so I like that she's actually just planting little seeds for us so that we will go and track down these other great works of literature to continue our conversation with these books that are speaking to us.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, Bea, it's just been great, as John says, just delightful to have you on the show for a lively and just a really thought-provoking conversation. I mean, this has just been really great. Again, to our listeners, it's the tip of the iceberg. There's so many gems, and I'll tell you, some of them are like big ideas, and some of them are little tiny things that you're like, no way, right? So it's just a little gem that you get there, and you are going to be delighted by this book, and I think that it will help you to see J.K. Rowling's work in a different light in one way or another, and as I've said before, like, I think this is going to be, you know, just a pivotal book. Anybody, you know, starting to look into Harry Potter and its meaning, I think this is a really good starting place, really. You guys can check this out for yourselves by looking at some excerpts from Dr. Groves' book on HogwartsProfessor.com, and of course MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site. Then of course we hope that you'll also buy the book too, because you will not be disappointed. So thanks to...
I'm giving a free class as we speak online. On actually three classes. It's the Potter Pundit Summer School in the first weeks of August, where I'll be talking about intertextuality, intra-textuality, and cross-textuality, and I will be citing this book left and right.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been really lovely chatting with you both.
That's great. And I think if people want to get access to the course and to some of the free materials and free classes that you have, they can go to Hogwarts Professor. Is that right, John?
Hogwarts Professor and the new site, PotterPundits.com, which is really going to be an online place for actual classes, affordable and accessible.
That's great. And I think that, you know, Bea, your book really, as we've said, is an example of how, you know, Harry Potter deserves to be taken seriously. And we thank also our listeners who also are interested in taking Harry Potter seriously. We hope you enjoyed our discussion about some of the many literary allusions in Harry Potter. And listeners, if you'll leave your comments and questions for us in the comment box, let us know your thoughts, continuing questions, things that you'd like to hear more about. We also hope that you'll join us next time for another episode of Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter, right here on MuggleNet. So with that, I'll leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, whose name we now understand a little bit better, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." So we'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.